Hello, I'm Eric Huang. You're listening to Saint Podcast, a podcast about the always fascinating and often controversial lives of the saints. This is a history and culture podcast that traces the origins of morality tales of the saints, or hagiographies, through queer and feminist stories, ancient legends and lore, art history, and pop culture. This is I Am Milk, a special podcast episode inspired by an exhibition at the Wellcome Collection in London entitled Milk. The exhibition explores our relationship with milk and its place in politics, society, and culture. Judeo-Christian legends are filled to the brim with stories about milk, from lactating saints to a promised land of milk and honey, and a Christian morality that's developed around the symbolism of the white fluid. I Am Milk is a special Saint podcast episode that delves into the link between saints' legends and milk. The word milk appears about 45 times in the Bible. It's used to symbolize nourishment and growth, both physical and spiritual. It has healing properties. Milk is a valuable gift that represents generosity, also prosperity, wealth. Milk is formative. In Hebrews chapter 5, verses 12 to 13, the writer chastises the audience that although they ought to be teachers already, they still need milk rather than solid food, meaning they still lack the foundations of theology to understand more complex, mystical concepts to be effective teachers. Milk and its whiteness are linked with purity. Milk is love and comfort, as in the bond between a nursing infant and their mother. Earlier this year in May, I had a chat with Honor Bedard and Marianne Templeton, co-curators at the Wellcome Collection for Milk. Here they are to introduce themselves and tell us about what they do.
My name's Honor Bedard. I'm an exhibitions curator at Wellcome Collection. I've been working here for about 10 years and don't really have a specialty in the sense that we get all sorts of different topics. The lovely thing about our job is that you get to look into a really wide range of different issues. As a curator at the Wellcome, I've worked on exhibitions such as the Institute of Sexology, Making Nature, which was about the relationship between humans and animals, Smoke and Mirrors, which was about the psychology of magic, and then most recently, Milk.
My name is Marianne Templeton. I'm a project curator on the Milk exhibition at Wellcome Collection. And again, I don't really have a specialty either, although I did do a research master's in artist moving image. So I guess that's probably my area of knowledge. This is my first exhibition at Wellcome Collection. It's a really exciting one to start with.
The Wellcome Collection is a free museum and library in London that aims to challenge how we all think and feel about health. I asked Honor and Marianne why the museum decided to hold an exhibition about milk.
We thought that milk would be a really interesting subject for an exhibition because it's one of those things that almost everybody in the UK has some familiarity with, whether it's tea or coffee, what goes into your cereal in the morning, or something that you can't help but think a lot about if you're feeding a small child. That kind of everydayness of milk, the fact that it's woven into those daily routines, really disguises the fact that it also taps into these really big questions, really political questions actually, around diet and our food systems, how we feed our children, and the relationship that we have with other animals and with the environment. And I guess what really struck us was that milk affects every aspect of our lives, whether we drink it or not.
At Wellcome Collection, we create exhibitions that explore health and the human experience. This is our first exhibition to look at nutrition and diet, and we look at these through a historical and social lens, asking how has milk come to be seen as so essential in the UK, and who decides what constitutes a good diet. The exhibition includes over 120 objects, and these range from objects of utility used in farming or infant feeding to advertising posters and archival documents, as well as contemporary artwork, which includes three newly commissioned pieces. And the exhibition's grouped into five thematic sections. So the story of milk asks us to consider where our ideas about milk come from in the UK, and how the stories we're told affect the choices we make as consumers and caregivers. The milk problem examines how the introduction of science into agriculture created the systems of dairy production that exist today. Scientific motherhood looks at the emergence of the idea in 19th century Europe and North America that mothers need expert scientific advice in order to raise their children both successfully and safely, and it considers how this reshaped our ideas of motherhood. Good Health explores how the rise of nutritional science created an image of milk as the perfect food because of its unique combination of nutrients, and how it has been used by the state to control diets, bodies and lands. And finally, The Cost of Milk features the work of artists, writers and performers who are exploring the ethics and economies of milk today. And it asks how we value milk and those who produce it. In terms of how we came up with the sections, it was a very long process, wasn't it, of sifting through a huge amount of material and then trying to sort of find the kind of common themes that were coming out. And I think sort of putting those into a social and political context, really.
I think one of the things that we found challenging but also really exciting was that there was a lot of overlap between sort of human and non-human animal milk. And so while the exhibition kind of weaves between those two different types of milk, and we really wanted to draw out some of the connections that we could see forming and the way that, for instance, science was sort of starting to shape agriculture, but also starting to shape ideas around motherhood and infant feeding, and then also starting to change how we thought about food and eating through the science of nutrition. So we've tried to kind of show how different ways that we think about milk might be affected by similar themes and similar forces and structural forces in society.
The Welcome exhibition focuses on cow's milk and human milk. The milk mentioned in the Bible comes not just from humans and cows, but a variety of animals, specifically goats, sheep, and camels. Goat's milk would have been the most commonly used by the peoples in the Bible. All milk, no matter the source, carries the symbolism of nourishment we mentioned earlier. In medieval legends that arose in the centuries after the Bible's creation, milk took on much more mystical qualities. Let's hear from Honor and Marianne, who tell us about a saint famous for obtaining superhuman powers after ingesting milk from the Virgin Mary.
In the exhibition, we display an etching in brown ink entitled Saint Bernard of Clairvaux Kneeling Before the Virgin and Christ Child. It dates from 1766, and it's by Andreas Gercetti the Younger, after Bernardino Pacetti. The etching shows Bernard kneeling before a vision of the Virgin Mary with the infant Christ on her knee, and she's surrounded by cherubs and angels, and she is squirting milk from her breast, which Bernard is kind of receiving into his mouth. And this print is illustrating a story that's often called the Lactation of Saint Bernard, in which this 12th century monk is said to have sought help from the Virgin Mary and then seen her in a vision. And the milk that he received is said to have granted him wisdom and eloquence. He went on to deliver a large number of sermons and writings on the right way to holiness. The fact that eloquence is mentioned here is really important, and the idea that this kind of superior milk of the Virgin is granting him sort of superior ability to speak and to write and to preach the word of God is really interesting. And we were talking earlier about how actually there's a kind of strange contemporary parallel in the way that you might today sort of see a tin of infant formula, which makes claims to being a better form of food for your child, and that it will, you know, give them better intelligence and greater height and growth and all of these things. And the way that this idea of there being a better form of milk is maybe something that runs throughout the exhibition as well.
We covered the legend of Saint Bernard in a bonus episode, available for Spotify subscribers and Patreon supporters. In summary, a story that appeared in the decades after Bernard's death tells us it was milk from a sculpture of the Virgin Mary, which miraculously came to life, that filled Bernard with the theological knowledge, divine inspiration, and eloquence necessary to write his many treatises and conduct moving sermons. Saint Bernard isn't the only Christian figure to have tasted the Virgin Mary's milk. The Blessed Paula of Florence had help from an infant Christ who squeezed 3 drops of his mother's milk onto the lips of the devout canoness. In medieval writings, healing properties are the most commonly extolled qualities of the Madonna's milk. The bishop, Fulbert of Chartres, who died a year before Bernard was born, recounted in a letter how the Virgin Mary visited him in a dream while he was deathly ill. She, quote, bathed his tongue with milk she had recently expressed from her breast. When the bishop woke up, he was healed. Thank you so very much for listening to Saint Podcast. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting us on Patreon. For as little as the cost of a cup of coffee every month, your patronage will help keep Saint Podcast going, as well as unlock access to bonus episodes, a behind-the-scenes peek at what we do, and free Saint Podcast merchandise as part of your support. Head to www.patreon.com/saintpodcast. As always, Saint is spelled out, S-A-I-N-T. Thanks again for listening. The French abbot and musician Gautier de Coincy, who composed poetry in veneration of the Virgin Mary, created verses around what's presented as a true story about a devout monk who falls ill. The monk's face, mouth, and throat erupt in painful sores and open ulcers. Here are Coincy's words to describe what happens next. With much sweetness and delight, from her sweet bosom she drew forth her breast, that is so sweet, so soft, so beautiful, and placed it in his mouth, and gently touched him all about, and sprinkled him with her sweet milk. Once the Virgin Mary departed, the monk was cured. Numerous nuns, monks, and other clerics who drank milk directly from the Madonna found relief from leprosy, ulcers, broken bones, and a variety of psychological conditions. The visionary Margarita Ebner became a mystical version of the Virgin Mary to suckle Christ herself. She described the experience in a letter. I have an image of the child, our Lord, in a cradle. I was so powerfully compelled by my Lord with great sweetness, longing, and desire, and also by his request, because it was said to me by my Lord, if you don't give me to suckle, then I will take myself away at the moment you love me most. So I took the image out of the cradle and laid it on my bare breast with great longing and sweetness, and felt the strangest possible grace in the presence of the Lord. My longing and my desire is to nurse the Christ child. The German mystic Adelheid also suckled Christ. Rather than the command from God that Ebner heeded, it was at the Virgin Mary's insistence that Adelheid bared her breasts when the Madonna and child joined her in bed. The Virgin Mary has also gifted the mystical properties of her milk to others. Saint Lidvina, who's the patron saint of ice skating, had a dream on the night of Christmas. Here's an account from a medieval hagiography. Lidvina had a vision of the Virgin Mary and a host of other holy women surrounding her bed, opening their tunics and lactating into the sky. The next morning, Lidvina awakened to discover she was lactating as well, despite being a virgin. She knew at once she was meant to nurse her maid, and so she did. Scholars have interpreted this miraculous lactation of a virgin saint as a medieval cover-up to hide an unwanted pregnancy caused by a local priest. As Marianne said, the Virgin Mary's milk has divine properties, It's superior to the milk of mere mortals. In a similar vein, the contemporary sale and/or donation of human milk online is often accompanied by a CV or resume of sorts to promote an individual's milk as being of exceptional quality based on her accomplishments. Honor tells us more.
I think we see that in Jess Dobkin's commission, which is the final piece in the show called For What It's Worth. And she did a huge amount of research into human donor milk. So there's been a real proliferation of the sale and or donation of human milk online. And when you go onto the sites that sell human milk, it's really interesting what people use to promote it. It might be things like, I have a Harvard degree, or I'm vaccinated or I'm not vaccinated, or it might be things like, I only drink at weekends. How we sort of assign value to these substances and what sort of things we think can kind of be transmitted through it is really interesting. And when you hear it in a context like that, it sounds really strange. But then I also think about the sort of messages that go out with the kind of breastfeeding narratives. If you breastfeed your child, they will have a better immune system, they will have a better IQ. And of course, it becomes very difficult for mothers to unpick those narratives and sort of statistical evidence behind them. It's quite a fraught area, I think, for new parents. There was an economist who really did actually look, because she was a statistician, and she looked very much at the sort of claims, particularly around, so for example, breastfeeding would increase your child's IQ. Actually, once you factor out class and education and things like that, I think it was kind of 0.0 something.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard with nutritional studies to separate out lifestyle factors. The history of nutrition science is really entangled with industry. A lot of industrial chemists who were developing this science, they weren't neutral. They were actually commercial actors themselves.
Whilst there's no evidence to convincingly support the transmission of intelligence through milk, the Virgin Mary's milk is different. Her milk imparts divine wisdom and also salvation. The musician Quan Si, we mentioned earlier, wrote a poem about salvation that tells of a so-called Saracen, a pejorative term used to describe non-Christian people east of Europe. The allegedly true story describes how this Eastern monarch converted to Christianity after a sculpture of the Virgin Mary miraculously animated to expose her breasts. She then lactated a milky oil, which was later found to have healing properties. The Virgin Mary's milk can even save those who are already dead. A painting that illustrates this hangs at the Prado Museum in Madrid. It's by a painter named Pedro Machuca, who studied with artists in Rome close to Michelangelo and Raphael. A young Virgin Mary sits upon a throne supported by a cloud held aloft by Cupid-like angels. Her light red blouse exposes both breasts. She squeezes her right breast with her right hand, expressing milk to the tortured souls in a darkly painted purgatory just beneath the bright white clouds. The Christ child stands on Mary's left knee. He squeezes her left breast with both hands whilst looking directly at the viewer. We can see one of the souls below in purgatory turning their head upwards to collect the milk that falls like rain into their open mouth. Art historians point out that this depiction of the Virgin Mary spraying milk into the space between heaven and purgatory is a Christianization of an ancient Greco-Roman image of a goddess expressing her milk into the cosmos to create the Milky Way. The painter Tintoretto created a work of art in the late 16th century to illustrate this story. A baby Hercules is given to Juno, called Hera by the Greeks. He's hungry for milk, and Juno reluctantly consents. But the baby pulls too hard. Even as an infant, Hercules possessed superhuman strength. The extreme pain forces the goddess to push the baby away, spraying her milk across the heavens. You can see this painting at the National Gallery in London. It's also on the Saint Podcast website, www.saintpodcast.com. Saint is spelled out, S-A-I-N-T. Incidentally, The Egyptians believed the Milky Way to be a pool of spilled milk that came from the goddess of the sky, the sun, and sex. Her name is Hathor, often depicted as half-human, half-cow. Many souls in purgatory paintings, like the one by Pedro Machuca, exist. They attest to devotions to the Virgin Mary as an intercessor between mortals and her son, and also to the essential qualities of milk. It's this very human act of expressing milk, however, that made Marian devotion so controversial in the Reformation of the 1600s. It's one of the many factors that drew criticisms from factions that would eventually form various Protestant denominations. The papacy enacted counter-Reformation decrees to prohibit beliefs and practices that verged on heresy, such as showing the Virgin Mary's breasts in art, which were often overtly sexualized. But whilst artists in Catholic countries changed tact, Protestants in the North, who didn't hold the Virgin Mary in the same divine regard, continued to emphasize her humanness with a proliferation of paintings called Madonna Lactans. We discussed the Madonna Lactans in detail in the St. Bernard bonus episode, but it's worth revisiting this iconography in the context of milk. Madonna Lactans paintings depict the Virgin Mary breastfeeding Christ. Older medieval examples are very stylized, with breasts painted as strangely shaped discs emerging from the shoulders or neck. Once the Renaissance changed the way human forms were depicted, however, the breasts became more natural and idealized, voluptuous, sensual. Artworks from this era and beyond range from quite tender depictions of a mother nursing her son to undeniably erotic works of art in which Christ looks like a naughty schoolboy grinning while grabbing a handful of his mother's breasts. Many Madonna Lactans were quite scandalous. The Melun diptych by Jean Fouquet is an extraordinary example. It was painted before the Counter-Reformation decrees and looks postmodern, even though it's dated to 1452. What was so shocking wasn't the nudity and stylized forms. It was the fact that the Virgin Mary's face and exposed breast were likenesses of Agnes Sorel, one of the most beautiful women of her time and the mistress of King Charles VII of France. King Charles was the party who commissioned the painting, which was chiefly used for private devotion. Another remarkable Madonna Lactans is at the German Nisches Museum in Nuremberg. It's commonly referred to as Madonna with the Parrots. The painting is by Hans Baldung, a 16th century German artist. Baldung's Virgin is a beautiful pale-skinned woman with auburn hair. A pearl necklace adorns her neck. She pulls down the top of her dress to expose the left breast. A rather large young Christ, who looks like he's about 8 or 9, sits across her lap. He looks at the viewer whilst feeding, frowning as if he's annoyed. A small angel with the face of an old man flies in from the upper left, holding aloft a veil. What looks like an African gray parrot sits on Mary's left shoulder, the red tail almost brushing the halo on Christ's head. A second parrot, a green parakeet in the shadows, alights on what might be a white handkerchief. Parrots appear in a number of Marian paintings. There's no consensus to explain their presence. The bird's uncanny ability to mimic human voices has been linked with repeating and amplifying the Word of God. They might also symbolize the Immaculate Conception and Mary's purity. According to Father Johann G. Rotin of the University of Dayton, quote, Marian emblems sometimes show the parrot perched on the highest and thin branch of a tree, and so out of reach of the menacing serpent, again a symbol of Mary's exemption of original sin. The Welcome Collection's Milk exhibition features a handful of Madonna Lactans postcards.
So we have a selection of postcards in the exhibition which show different images of paintings of the nursing Madonna. And these cards come from a collection that was made by a pediatrician called Ronald McKeith between the 50s and the 70s. And he actually collected these images of historical artworks to use in his teaching and to sort of demonstrate the different techniques of latching for breastfeeding. One thing that really struck us about these different representations is that they're all these really idealized representations. Some of them are really awkwardly depicted as well, you know, like the one breast is kind of peeping out of the costume, possibly up too high near the neck. It's slightly anatomically wrong. And I think that very like unrealistic depiction was one of the reasons why these images were able to proliferate. And as painting became more realistic, it did become seen as something that was more sexualized, and you started to lose this type of imagery. In, I think, 1593, the Catholic Church banned the nudity of sacred figures in art. And so this imagery mostly proliferated around the 15th century.
It was quite a strange find, wasn't it? Because we looked in the files in our archives of paediatrician Ronald McKeith, and you have all this literature and back and forth with other sort of academics. And then you open up this file and it's full of postcards and notelets. Some that he collected, he asked Slide Libraries, I think, to get for him. But you've also got friends and family sending him holiday postcards. Well, you can imagine sort of saying, oh, Ronald would like this one. And he collects them all as sort of teaching aids. And there's a note on a picture of the Tintoretto painting, The Origins of the Milky Way, where he talks about it showing a draft reflex in action, or letdown reflex, causing a spray of milk from the nipple. And we thought, what does it mean if this is a teaching aid, and then your students, presumably predominantly male, take on that knowledge and then it gets passed down as a new mother or as someone attempting to breastfeed? How does that information differ from your experience, which might be talking to kind of new parents, very hard, very messy, very uncomfortable, filled with feelings of failure and lack of success and lack of understanding to some degree? We don't really teach breastfeeding in this country. We don't learn it about it in schools. People are very sheltered from the reality of it, unless you've grown up in a family where perhaps you see your mother do it, I don't know, an older sister. We have very little understanding, and then the reality hits and it's a bit late. I think images like this, the sort of very idealised images, just perpetuate that huge gap between the reality and what you're shown it's going to be like or told it's going to be like.
I think too, the depiction of breastfeeding as this almost as this spiritual act is kind of elevating it to this point where it does become really difficult for people to decide that they don't want to breastfeed, or if they're in a position where they can't, and then to have to confront the public expectations that have been set around this act.
I was thinking about the Atalanta Fugin's book that's next to St. Bernard, etching, and that idea of Mother Earth as the sort of life giver, and she, you know, literally breastfeeding, and how the Madonna and that kind of Mother Earth figure, you know, the kind of Madonna is the kind of mother to everybody. Link comes through there.
That book also speaks to this idea of the transmission of characteristics. Alongside this Mother Earth, there are depictions of Romulus and Remus being fed by a she-wolf and of Jupiter being fed by a goat. And so this idea that the characteristics of these animals would pass through to the human children is kind of also represented as part of this literal natural order almost.
It's interesting in terms of present day human feeding, breastfeeding. If there's problems, you know, maybe the kind of baby's having reflux or kind of colic things, asking the mother, well, have you been eating this? Or have you been eating that? And the kind of just one of so many things that get burdens that get put on the mother. Or yet another thing to scrutinise, am I doing a good job?
Madonna Lacton's paintings, postcards, and other reproductions of the artworks were used through the 20th century to teach mothers how to breastfeed. Imagine having to live up to the example of the Virgin Mary as a model mother. Never mind that many of the images are anatomically incorrect, and others so idealized that it's impossible to even approach their paradigm, like the proportions and physique of stereotypical Barbie. The book next to the St. Bernard etching that Honor and Marianne refer to is a leather-bound tome by Michael Mayer from 1618. It's open to an illustration that looks a bit like a Madonna Lacton's, an unusual one. It shows the Earth itself as a globe with a woman's head, two arms, two legs, and two breasts. She holds an infant to her right breast, which represents her son, Christ, and through her son, humanity and salvation. An infant Jupiter or Zeus suckles from a goat at the bottom left, while the legendary founders of Rome, the twins Romulus and Remus, suckle from a wolf. A motto above the illustration reads, "The Earth is her or his nurse." The image links legendary figures raised on milk with the Virgin Mary, and links the Virgin Mary to the Earth. In this illustration, she's life itself, the savior of us all. The Virgin Mary's iconography can be traced back to ancient earth goddesses and fertility divinities, all of whom represent creation and motherhood. Madonna Lactans' images have cognates in Taoist, Buddhist, Hindu, and other religious traditions in which a mother breastfeeds a creator god. Like all of these divine mothers, the Virgin Mary is a representation of the perfect mother, and the age-old image of a mother and child, a perceived perfect bond. Here are Marianne and Honor to describe a work by Henry Moore that interrogates the idealized bond between a nursing mother and her child that's represented and reinforced by the Madonna Lactans.
There's a small maquette for Mother and Child by Henry Moore, which is maybe a smaller piece in the show. It's not one of the larger works, but for me, it's a really interesting counterpoint to a lot of the imagery that we've been talking about, in that it's a sculptural piece with a mother and a child seated on her knee. Her breast is kind of like a round apple shape. Her face is made of spikes. And this child is almost a snake-like creature that is both fused to her and also kind of, she's got her hand out pulling the child and pushing the child. You're not quite sure. But what you can tell about this work is that it's a real moment of fraught tension and violence. What I really like about this piece is that it really pushes back against all of these depictions of feeding an infant as something that is only about intimacy and calmness and being aligned in what is good for you, and really points to the fact that what is best for a child is not always what is best for mother, and that that relationship can be really difficult. And I think the acknowledgement of that is something hopefully a lot of visitors with children can relate to.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that idea that breastfeeding is a way of bonding with your child is, of course, absolutely true. But I think for many mothers, it's very difficult and very painful. And so it's not actually a bonding experience for them. And then the narratives that I've put out around it make you feel like you're a bad mother if you're not bonding with your child in that way, that there's something wrong with you and you'll go into the bad mother camp.
We humans idealize motherhood. We also idealize milk as a perfect food.
We talk about milk as essential. But I think that word essential really sums it up, doesn't it? Because it's sort of essential in the sense that we need it, but it's also that essence of life, that life-giving fluid. And the idea that it's not just going to give you physical nourishment, it's going to give you spiritual nourishment or salvation. We open the exhibition with a large hanging sculpture by the artist Julia Bornfeld. It sort of references both the udder and the breast. I think that relationship between the animal and the human, we've tried to sever that connection. But actually a lot of our ideas around purity and goodness, the messaging that goes out around dairy milk, come from that connection with human milk, as particularly, as you say, the kind of early symbolism around the kind of Madonna and the saints, milk being a way of transmitting the grace of God. The rise of nutritional science in the 20th century and the hailing of milk as this perfect food sort of gets to the heart of that. Milk is nutritionally good and morally good.
For us, a key question was, why have we come to see milk as so essential? And that really, I guess, was a key kind of research question as we were developing the exhibition. It led to us really interrogating some of these ideas around personal choice as well, and the way that often when we talk about something like infant feeding or diet and what we eat, it's often cast as a personal choice or a personal responsibility. But we really wanted to dig into the question of who has a choice in that situation, like who actually does have a choice.
The Moral Christian Goodness of Milk, discussed by Honor and Marianne, and in particular the link that milk and breastfeeding have to the ideal of charity, is illustrated by other objects at the exhibition.
We have a couple of objects in the show that speak to this. For instance, there's this memo from like the 1950s, I think, from the Foreign Office here in the UK, talking about all of this excess tinned milk that they're wanting to donate to UNICEF for distribution, ideally to Commonwealth countries. What this memo points to is the fact that this is seen as a charitable act, even though it's a way to get rid of surplus milk, and it's a way to kind of also get some good publicity for doing something generous, but actually it's a really economic decision. A lot of what we found during our research was this way of looking at distributing milk where it's both an act of charity and also an act of economic good. This idea that there's no downside to this, but obviously you could look at this in a different way and saying that milk is being inserted into diets, people are being given a food to eat rather than having a choice of what they eat, but there's a lot of problems with this model.
Milk's Christian connection to charity can be traced to ancient Rome, and a morality tale called Roman Charity, in which a woman named Pero secretly breastfeeds her father Cimon, who's been imprisoned for committing a crime, sentenced to starve to death. Pero's charity is the literal giving of herself to save her father. The story was commonly depicted, even found in the ruins of Pompeii, and still illustrated centuries later by artists like Rubens. Some depictions change the father to a mother to remove suggestions of incest. Still others added a child, Pero's infant son. In artworks depicting this version of the story, both Pero's mother and son share her breasts. Similar stories exist all over the world. A Chinese legend substitutes the Roman father and daughter with a middle-aged woman who suckles at her young daughter-in-law's breast because she's too ill to take solid foods. The story, which dates to the Zhou dynasty, is a morality tale about filial piety to illustrate a child's duty to their in-laws. Closely linked to charity is milk's association with Christian temperance movements in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Here's Marianne to tell us why.
Bodily fluids and food are like really problematic in Christianity because they are things that are outside the body that could possibly pollute the body. They could lead to excess. With the Virgin Mary and with the idea of her lactating, it suggests that she's had sex. And so there's an idea that this is slightly problematic to understand how she has come to give milk, because milk is thought of as a white blood in medieval science. It's a very difficult ground to traverse in sort of how this is talked about and how it's understood. And I think definitely there's some gender politics at play there.
It's exactly this problematic nature of food and milk in Christian theology that temperance movements attempted to fix.
We have a couple of items relating to the connection between milk and temperance in the exhibition, and one of the objects is a small booklet from the National Food Reform Association, which is an early 20th century organization in Britain. This book is titled Economical Eating for Workers, and it's a tiny, tiny book full of really, really simple recipes using only like two or three ingredients mostly, for foods that you could make on a budget. This Food Reform Association was not just thinking about how to fuel and make a worker productive, they were also thinking about how temperance and the vegetarian diet could lead to good behavior, and not just of the individual, but of society. So they were hoping to influence what people ate for the betterment of society. Most of these recipes, none of them contain meat, but they contain a lot of dairy as a protein substitute. And so we actually see milk being quite common in early vegetarian cooking in the UK, but also tied up with these ideas of temperance and moral goodness through these types of materials.
And I think that also speaks to the way that a lot of vegetarians, for many years, it was seen as if you were doing a kind of self-denial by not eating meat. A sort of self-flagellation almost. I'm going to deny myself. Yeah, the word balanced in eating is so interesting, isn't it? So loaded.
The early 20th century booklet mentioned by Marianne presents milk as a healthy, morally good alternative to meat, which, unlike milk, is characterized as a rich food and a sinful indulgence. Temperance movements also promoted milk as an alternative to alcohol. The organizations lobbied for free milk to be served to factory workers and milk booths to be set up in town centers to draw the populace away from pubs and bars. These measures were not effective. Centuries earlier, however, milk was viewed by the church in Rome as no different from meat, a luxury and delicacy that inflamed carnal appetites just like the alcohol and animal flesh temperance movements attempted to control. Dairy products were included in the foods Christians weren't allowed to eat on fasting days.
One thing that you probably have come across in your research, but we thought about including this in the exhibition, we didn't in the end, was these 14th and 15th, 16th century recipes for almond milk, which we find in almost all cookbooks from around that time. And actually, this is related to Christianity in that almond milk was used as a substitute for days when you couldn't have meat or animal products. Almond milk actually has this really long history that is really tied up to trying to find an alternative. And so it's a really, really common recipe. I just find it interesting that it has a much longer history. It's not just a hipster food.
Well, I was thinking about the butter tower in, is it Rome?
Yeah, I think so.
Where it was sort of crowdfunded. Because it was funded by people paying charitable donations that meant they were allowed to eat fat and animal products on days when they shouldn't be.
And as you would know, like days when you couldn't have animal products were every Wednesday, every Saturday, and then all of Lent, and then every day before a feast day. Like it was a lot of days, so that it wasn't just like a small amount of time that you might need to find this substitute. It was actually something that would have been consumed quite a lot.
So I love the fact that economics is creeping in even there.
Yeah.
The butter tower isn't literally a tower made of butter, but one of three towers in the Cathedral of Rouen in northern France. The tower was terribly expensive to construct, so the Pope, Alexander VI, granted dispensations to eat as much milk and dairy during fasting days in exchange for cash to fund the building project. Because of this, the structure was nicknamed the Butter Tower, which is what it's still known as today. The magical properties of milk to heal, nourish, and inspire predate Christianity. We mentioned in passing Zeus suckling from a goat as an infant. Zeus's father, Cronus, swallowed all of his children as they were born for fear of a prophecy predicting his downfall at the hands of his sons and daughters. Zeus's mother, Rhea, tricked Cronus by replacing the newborn Zeus with a stone swaddled in baby clothes. Zeus was then sent away to a cave to be raised by the goat Amalthea. When Zeus came of age, he overthrew his father. Once he became head of the new gods, he honored his goat nursemaid by making her the constellation Capra. We also mentioned the legendary founders of the city of Rome, Romulus and Remus, twin brothers who threatened the rule of their uncle, King Amulius, who abandoned them on the banks of the Tiber River to die. The protector god of the river, named Tibernius, saved the twins and delivered them to a wolf who suckled and raised them. A Christian saint also survived by suckling an animal. According to the Golden Legend, Saint Giles is a 7th century Greek prince from Athens who gives up his aristocratic life to live in the wilderness. He survived by drinking the milk of his sole companion, a red deer. Hunters stumble upon Giles' retreat one day and inadvertently shoot him instead of the deer they were tracking. Giles refuses treatment, allowing God to heal him instead. You can easily spot St. Giles in paintings, because he's nearly always accompanied by his dear friend. When Saint Christina the Astonishing was a child, she survived 9 weeks hiding in a forest by ingesting her own breast milk, which miraculously flowed after she prayed for help. This saint would later die at the age of 21, only to resurrect at her funeral and live to be 74, quite the achievement in the 13th century. Nearly every ancient culture believed ingesting the milk of an animal would imbue the drinker with that animal's properties. Lion's milk provided courage and strength. Ibex milk was thought to make you faster. Fox milk, more cunning. It's not unlike the Virgin Mary imparting her qualities of divine eloquence and wisdom through milk. For Hindus, milk and its products have purifying properties. Clarified butter called ghee is used in ceremonial lamps. Confectionery made from milk is offered to divinities in religious rituals, and the sculptures of the gods themselves are washed in milk. A goddess known as Surabhi or Kamadhenu is the mother of all cows. In art, she appears with a woman's head and torso and the body of a white zebu or Brahman cow, a distinctive domestic breed from the Indian subcontinent with a hump on its back. This goddess also has a peacock tail and bird wings. She's a miraculous symbol of plenty, a cow that provides their owner with anything they want in any quantity they require. Ancient legends tell of how she was created when the gods churned one of the seven oceans into a milky froth to obtain an elixir of immortality called Amrita. Surabhi was one of the deities who emerged along with the elixir. Once churned, the body of water was renamed the Ocean of Milk. The Aztec goddess Mayahuel, who reigns over an agave plant called maguey, is often shown lactating milk-like substances procured from the plant. One of these fluids is aqua miel, literally water honey, which has therapeutic qualities. The fermented form of aqua miel, pulque, also called milk of the earth, is enjoyed as an alcoholic drink. A plumed fish is often illustrated suckling from Mayahuel. The fish represents the Aztec ancestral line. The pulque they drink from the goddess is the knowledge mothers pass on to their children. There's a famous apparition of the Virgin Mary associated with Mayahuel. It's an image of the Lady of the Apocalypse that appeared miraculously in Mexico on the 12th of December, 1531, imprinted on the cloak of a Chimichec saint named Juan Diego. The Madonna stands on a crescent moon. Her eyes are closed. She holds her hands together in prayer. The aquamarine color of the cloak she wears is one reserved only for the creator and fertility gods of the Aztec pantheon. And the spiky rays of light emanating all around her resembled the spikes of the maguey plant. In the West, we call this mystical image Our Lady of Guadalupe. Locals refer to her as Mother of Maguey. The Madonna's association with the plant goes so deep that another term for the alcoholic drink pulque is milk of the Virgin. Every culture ascribes divine, nourishing powers to milk, given to humans by goddesses to inspire, enlighten, and save. Females aren't the only sacred figures to express milk, though. Saint Bernard described his own missionary work as a mother feeding a newborn.
A lot of Saint Bernard's writings actually use these types of maternal metaphors for imparting of spiritual sustenance through milk, and he often wrote about himself spreading his teachings in this way and referencing some of the tenderness and sweetness of the breast milk as a kind of metaphor for his teachings.
Saint Bernard used the metaphor of milk and breastfeeding to describe his work. Saint Francis is a male saint who expressed milk. We discussed the vision Saint Clare had in the Mystics episode dedicated to her, in which she suckled from Saint Francis's nipples to receive his wisdom. As you'll recall, one of his nipples detached itself to remain in Claire's mouth. Christ himself also provided divine milk, symbolically in the form of the blood he spilled at the crucifixion. In the Middle Ages, milk was referred to as white blood. Christ's blood and his mother's milk were linked together as substances given freely to nourish and save. Numerous saints drank out of an adult Christ's side wound, his blood being a substance that nourished physically and spiritually, while saving the faithful from damnation, just like the Virgin Mary's milk. Christ's milk is also literal. A handful of male and female figures have suckled from Christ in mystical visions. The legend of Saint Margaret of Cortona tells us she suckled at the breast of an infant Christ to receive spiritual wisdom and comfort. Scholars have attributed the medieval trend linking Christ's blood with Mary's milk to gender politics. These newly developed stories featuring male saints and other sacred figures breastfeeding fulfilled a need to demonstrate how a female divinity's power, which was accepted as hers alone, was now shown to be not so special, something men could also do. Tales of lactating men and the mystical powers of milk waned as the Age of Enlightenment dawned and science replaced many folk practices. Milk's association with Christianity from this period onwards is complicated. It was the Franciscans from Spain who brought dairy farms to the Americas. They introduced cow's milk and cheese, and cows themselves, to the indigenous peoples, as conquistadors and missionaries pushed north from what is today Mexico into California to claim the land, its resources, and people for the Spanish crown and the church. Father Junipero Serra, the Franciscan friar and saint who set up many of the missions, wrote in 1772 that milk was the friars' miners' quote, chief subsistence. Milk wasn't the chief subsistence of the indigenous population. Scholars Tomasz Kamusela and Russell K. Skowronek both mention how the introduction of dairy products in the Americas and Japan by missionaries weakened local populations who lacked the enzyme to digest lactose. Drinking cow's milk and dairy farming were part of the Christian package missionaries promoted to non-European cultures that included beef, pork, and beer, alongside Christian theology and Eurocentric perspectives on the best way to farm and live, presented as the only way to farm and the only way to live. Let's hear from Honor and Marianne to tell us about the connection between British colonialism and milk.
I think in our research for the exhibition, we're very interested in the way that English and European colonisers were taking their cattle with them, and the owning of cattle became a sort of condition for taking this land that they claimed to be unoccupied. It was initially a way to continue their own diet. So, you know, if you were used to having dairy, then you needed to find a way to sustain that in the countries they colonised. But of course, it very much went on to become a way to overwrite the ways of those that they were, you know, the lands and the people that they were colonising. And I think this idea that it was a civilising mission, so that they were improving on the agriculture that was there, or improving population health. And of course, it's based on the notion of superiority of the colonisers, that sort of European nutritional science was the only way to understand food and diet. And we have a fantastic piece in the exhibition by Danielle Dean called White.
Danielle Dean's piece White, which is actually a new commission for the exhibition, is a large-scale animation, hand-drawn in watercolour. It takes as its starting point this really small collectible card that would have been clipped from the edge of a packet of Thai food tea in the 1930s. And this card came from a series of cards under the theme of industries of the British Empire. Each card represented a different area of the empire and a different type of colonial industry. A lot of these were raw materials that were then being brought back to Britain for manufacturing. The dairy farming card that is set in an area of New Zealand called Taranaki portrays Mount Taranaki in the background and then a kind of green pasture in the foreground dotted with dairy cattle. And Danielle has basically reworked this image and blown it up, looked into the heritage of the region around Mount Taranaki, consulting with Ngururhine Iwe, which is one of Iwe or Maori groups in that region, and created a version of the landscape that existed before the area was cleared for these dairy pastures. This is a very heavily forested area. It's beautifully drawn with a lot of detail representing the different plants indigenous to that region and a bird which is now extinct. Daniel describes this work as like a moving painting, and it's a panorama in which this beautiful forest fills the screen, but then gradually starts to be encroached upon by these different white forms that start to bleach out the landscape and to devastate the forest. There's a sort of white liquid that drops down. There's a kind of white fungus that spreads across the leaves, a sort of smoky texture in the background. The forest becomes devastated, then reduced to this green pasture land that we see in the advertising card, which today for us in England actually looks like a natural landscape. We're not used to seeing green fields and thinking this is actually the aftermath of land clearing. We see that as a form of nature. And so the way that she's moving between these two landscapes really highlights the way that we maybe have started to see agricultural landscapes as natural landscapes. The animation is on a loop and it merges back into the forest at the end. So Danielle's really thinking about the possibility of regeneration of the forest in that region, because it isn't entirely cleared. It's still about 10% in existence.
I was really struck by the fact that Danielle Dean refers to that kind of image of the deforested area of Mount Taranaki. She says that the Maori communities who live there refer to it as the Green Desert, because to them it's not a natural landscape. As you say, perhaps a British person might look at that and think, oh, it looks very lush, you've got your cows grazing, this sort of little church-type building in the background, I think, isn't there? And I think it really says so much about how we use the word natural very uncritically and how it can be very loaded. Nearby, we have a newly commissioned documentary film by a filmmaker called Leo Hallam-Dawson, and he interviewed three farmers in the southwest of England who are all operating different forms of dairy farming. And one of the points that one of the farmers makes is that actually a lot of the land in England was also deforested long, long, long time ago. So what we actually think of as natural in England, of course, wasn't its so-called natural state.
There's another dark side to milk and Christianity. It stems from the metaphor of a promised land flowing with milk and honey. The phrase appears about 20 times in the Bible, depending on the version you're reading. All references are from the Old Testament, the Jewish books that form the bedrock of Christian teachings. Christian nationalists, particularly in the United States, have latched on to the concept of a God-given land of milk and honey, and have embraced milk as a symbol for an ideology that the Christian God gifted the United States as a promised land for the sole use of a very specific type of American. Here are Honor and Marianne to tell us about a confronting video in the exhibition.
It was quite shocking to us when we were researching for the show to find that milk had become fairly recently, I think around 2016, 2017, a symbol for the far right, particularly in the US, but picked up via social media around the world. We have a work in the exhibition by Luke Turner, which is documentation of a performance piece that he made in 2017 called He Will Not Divide Us. This work consisted of a live stream camera in a public area in the US where he was inviting people to come and speak to the camera at a time in the US when Donald Trump had recently been inaugurated. And there was a lot of kind of social division, which I think we're still seeing today. He was really inviting people to come and try and push back against that and to show messages of solidarity across those political lines. But actually, one of the things that happened was the live stream was crashed by these members of the far right who, you can see in the video documentation, swigging milk from really large milk gallon jugs and posturing for the camera and saying some very violent and racist things. Some anti-immigration messaging and referring to replacement theory and this idea that the white race is under threat. Milk is used in this situation as a demonstration of health and strength and white masculinity and all the connotations of purity that have been layered onto milk over history have also been pulled into this strange, absurd, quite frightening spectacle.
One of the reasons we wanted to include it is because we have a 1920s butter pamphlet that has a quote from Herbert Hoover, which was saying that dairy products have been key to the success of the white race. And we wanted people to see that this isn't something that's sort of left behind in history. This is still going on today. You know, milk and other foods are still being used to claim superiority or to try and kind of oppress others.
Milk symbolizes a purity and supremacy for racist organizations who use the milk emoji to bypass hate speech censors on social media. But even mainstream culture upholds milk as a supernatural substance in a problematic way. Honor tells us about a video on display that illustrates this.
We have an advert by the Milk Marketing Board, Milk Brings Out the Best in You. This glowing milk bottle rises up in a kind of triumphant music background, and it's sort of weirdly sort of quasi-religious and phallic at the same time. And then it just ends with milk brings out the best in you. And there's just sort of so much to unpack there, as if milk can somehow make you a better person. And then you think, well, okay, what is the best person? What do they look like? Where do they come from? What does their body look like? What kind of systems or values do they adhere to? I think that homogenising of bodies was something we saw again and again throughout the exhibition. You know, there's one right body, there's one right mother.
There's also one right way to prepare hot drinks like tea, coffee, and chocolate.
There's a piece in the show by an artist called Hiten Patel called How to Make a Proper Cup of Tea. It's a sort of spoof YouTube cooking show, and he talks through the process of making a good cup of tea. He's with somebody who's dressed up as the Tetley tea man who speaks Gujarati throughout, and he talks very much about how the dark tea is problematic and how you can make it better by adding white products. He talks about white sugar and milk. And it talks about the tea bag as having these borders that help to keep the kind of dark contained. At the end, he says, don't worry if your tea's looking a little bit dirty still. Here's one that I made earlier. And he produces this glass of milk, pure milk. And I think it's a really lovely way to talk about some of the very difficult histories of colonialism within both, of course, tea and milk. And that idea that tea is British, of course, being so absurd, and the way that that erases not only the kind of appropriation of that, but also the violence of that colonial history.
The language that he uses really resonates with the anti-immigration language that is used in the UK today. So it's also pointing to how these sentiments have just shifted.
There's a patron saint of dairy and milk, Saint Brigid. According to hagiographical sources, her birth coincides at sunrise with the moment her mother steps out of the house to milk the cows. Other legends describe how Brigid's mother bathes her in milk when she's born, an ancient Celtic tradition. Still other chronicles tell of priests baptizing the newborn saint in milk. What every hagiography agrees on is that Brigid grows up working on her parents' dairy farm. All of these anecdotes are evidence to support Brigid's title as the patron saint of dairy farmers and milk products. We'll delve into the legend of Saint Brigid, who's also one of the patron saints of Ireland, in a future Saint podcast episode. One of the most holy sites in Christendom is associated with the Virgin Mary's milk. It's in Bethlehem and believed to be the location where the Holy Family, Joseph, Mary, and a newborn Jesus, took shelter before fleeing to Egypt as refugees. Whilst they overnighted in the caves, a drop of the Virgin Mary's milk dripped onto the floor, turning it white. The site is now the Chapel of the Milk Grotto of Our Lady. It's inside a church built around a cave system, which has three separate grottos where miracles to cure infertility have been recorded. The popular milk grotto is said to be a place where prayers for and by children are particularly effective. The Virgin Mary's milk is a frequent component in holy relics. The Protestant reformer John Calvin wrote this about the sheer number of Virgin Mary milk relics in the 16th century. With regards to the milk, there is perhaps not a town, convent, or nunnery where it is not shown in large or small quantities. Indeed, had the Virgin been a wet nurse her whole life, or a dairy, she could not have produced more than is shown as hers in various parts. The ubiquity of Madonna milk relics can be traced to a white dust in the milk grotto. The powder was scraped into vials, then distributed to churches throughout Christendom and sold as souvenirs to pilgrims. The shrine of Our Lady of Walsingham was an often visited Marian pilgrimage site in England. Built in 1340 in the county of Norfolk, the basilica that houses the shrine is thousands of miles from Bethlehem, but was known for its ample supply of ampulli that contained 3 drops each of the Virgin Mary's milk, said to be sourced directly from the milk grotto. Female pilgrims were permitted to purchase the vials and drink the contents mixed with water for its healing powers. Whilst conducting research for this episode, I found several milk relics for sale on the internet, including an 18th century brass medallion containing a vial of the Virgin's milk, as usual, 3 drops in honor of the Trinity. Also housed in the relic was a lock of the Virgin Mary's hair. The website doesn't show any prices for the relics on sale. Interested buyers are instructed to email the seller in Russia. The milk of mortals can also be purchased and traded online. The milk exhibition at the Wellcome Collection ends with quite an extraordinary installation that investigates an online community of milk enthusiasts.
At the end of the exhibition, we have an installation by Jess Dobkin called For What It's Worth. This piece is a full room installation. It has a really different tone from the rest of the show. It is almost like an explosion of things and colours and lights. It's taking it as a starting point the subject of human donor milk and what happens when human milk starts to enter into the networks of exchange and commerce that dairy milk is already so enmeshed in. Her research project involved collaborating with a lot of different research partners. As you walk through the space, you can hear extracts of their conversation that, again, tap into all of these subjects around justice, questions of care and justice across species. What is the currency that we should use for human milk, if not economic? Is there a way we can think outside of the existing types of systems and networks? How could we look at different cultures and the way that milk kinship, for instance, the sharing of milk from one mother between a child and also a foster child. How can we think about milk as a relative substance in that way? There's a whole messy, unruly bundle of ideas that are kind of conveyed in this installation, both through the different voices that you hear and also the jumble of objects. Throughout the space, there are different sites represented where you might find breast milk today. For instance, the refrigerator where you might have your frozen milk stored, or the gym where you might find it being used as a bodybuilding supplement.
There's a site that refers to the use of milk for fetish. There's also a bar which references a piece that Jess Dobkin created a number of years ago now called The Lactation Station, where she invited people to come and taste human breast milk. And I don't think she was interested whether they did or didn't. She was interested in the conversations that they were having around that decision and where that came from. She's created a tit coin. You can see a large version of it at the bottom of the sort of pump that kind of fills the space. But also there's lots of the smaller tip coins near the end of the space. That very much speaks to that question about currency. So if your currency isn't money, what would it be? Would it be based on love? Would it be based on kindness, on community? One of the things that we were thinking about in that last section of the exhibition, the cost of milk, is about if we want to move forward, we have to move away from these polarising narratives of milk as good milk or bad milk. that's a sort of portrayal in the media, particularly around dairy milk. If we want to move forward, we've all got to start talking to one another. What Jess Dobkin does at the end is she brings everybody into that conversation and makes them realise that it's a conversation for you as a visitor. It doesn't matter if you're a parent, it doesn't matter if you don't drink dairy milk. Everybody needs to be in this conversation and thinking about what it means to be circulating dairy milk and human milk within the economy.
She makes the point too that human milk is not just a subject for women, it's a subject for society.
I think that's picked up in the queer nursing booklet that we have in the scientific motherhood section that really talks about nursing as everybody's responsibility. And I think one of the things that's happened in the past is there's been this huge, intense focus on the mother. And that's been very difficult because it means not only is there a lack of understanding generally about what support is needed, but it can also be very isolating for the mother, and that burden of responsibility and then sometimes feelings of failure can be very profound.
Jess Dobkin's For What It's Worth transports the viewer into an alternative universe to contemplate all of the things milk means to us, all of the things milk makes us think about. The installation is like a nightclub, a dark, neon-accented room minus the loud music. Large humanoid figures sit astride a fridge with vegan milk on its shelves. They hang upside down above a fetish bar that serves milk as a beverage. And they lurk atop a metal cabinet with the words, "The personal is political," in magnets down one side. And a big pink breast with a tassel dangling from the nipple perches high above on a wall. It's all here, the charity of providing free milk to those who need it, the sin of gluttony for those who fetishize and crave it, the temperance of vegan milk, the vanity that drives bodybuilders to use it in order to reach their goals, and the stark reality, the good and the bad, of motherhood.
The thinking about milk as either good or bad is really thinking about it in a moralizing way as well, both in terms of what we eat, how we produce food, and also in terms of infant feeding. We really need to get beyond this sort of moralizing framework because it's not going to get us anywhere.
The Milk exhibition at the Wellcome Collection invites guests to confront their assumptions and experiences with milk. It's a topic that touches on morality, commerce, politics, religion, and entrenched cultural practices, at once deeply personal with explorations of motherhood and childhood, and also surprising, thought-provoking with unfamiliar stories and unexpected rabbit holes. As the host of Saint Podcast, the exhibition, in particular Jess Dobkin's installation, evoked for me the following lines from Song of Songs, in which King Solomon describes the beauty of his indescribably beautiful bride. "Your lips drip honey, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garment is like the fragrance of Lebanon." Thank you so very much for listening to this special episode, I Am Milk, an exploration of milk in Christian legends inspired by the Wellcome Collection exhibition, Milk. Big thanks to Honor Bedard and Marianne Templeton, co-curators of the exhibition, for making time to chat with me. Thanks also to Lisa Thiel and Ajoa Bedu Ado from the agency Sutton, who set everything up and kept us all organized. And thank you to my friends Phoebe Harkins and Ross McFarlane, who also work at the Wellcome Collection. Thank you for helping me find the right people to talk with, and just for being the amazing people you are. For images of the artworks, people, and topics mentioned in the episode, please have a look at the Saint Podcast website at www.saintpodcast.com. And please feel free to email us at feedback@saintpodcast.com. The word saint is spelled out, S-A-I-N-T. Do also check out the Wellcome Collection's website for additional info about the exhibition, which runs through September 10th, 2023. Follow the Wellcome Collection on Twitter at @ExploreWellcome and Instagram at @WellcomeCollection. Wellcome is spelled with two L's. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for future special episodes.